Taking charge of your future starts with taking the first steps. And saving up to $30 a month on Cox Internet with the Affordable Connectivity Program makes those steps easy to take. Whether they bring you to click upload on your first short film or join now for an online book club. Applying is easy. See if you qualify at cox.com/ACP. Non-transferable, one per household. Application and eligibility decisions are made by the FCC.
Rising Giants Network.
I've lived the Civil War. 4th of August is nothing compared to the Civil War. Civil War, we used to have money, we used to have more safety because there was bombing, but we used to hide. On the 4th of August, actually, there was no place safe for us to hide.
You know, once we started realizing what happened and the terrible shock that happened, we decided that, you know, we have to take care of our community. We have to take care of the employees of the hospital, but also anyone that has been affected by the blast.
We all have our stories of the day of the explosion, and each of us has felt the impact of this enormous event. So you can just imagine what a child must have gone through that was close to the explosion site, and even children that were not close to the explosion site, children that were kilometers away, that felt the blast, that saw the pictures afterward, and were trying to make sense of what had happened in Beirut.
I usually put a post as a story, and I ask what is needed, and just people will donate and people would share the story, and 90% of the stuff that I get to help people are from people I don't know.
So after the explosion, around 4:30 a.m., after putting everyone in the hospitals and make sure that everyone is getting the necessary treatment, I called my contractor and I asked him to join me at my rig. And I told him, you have 1 week. I want to reopen my restaurant.
I'm Linda Tamim, and from the Rising Giants Network, this is the Beirut Blast. This podcast doesn't only recall the trauma lived by Beirut residents on August 4, 2020. It's also an opportunity to reflect on the year past, to mourn our loved ones, and to tell our story. And most importantly, never to forget. As a journalist working in Beirut, I was on the ground covering the events from the day of the explosion onwards. I witnessed destruction, trauma, and death. I've met with people who lost loved ones whose homes were destroyed and whose hopes and dreams were shattered. I spoke to many who, driven by desperation, were trying the impossible to leave Lebanon, whether by applying for immigration, by looking to work or study abroad, and even by embarking with their families on perilous journeys across the Mediterranean, trying to reach Cyprus illegally. The country has become hell on earth, they say, a jungle, a sinking ship. A place with no peace, a place with no safety or stability, a country with no future. Yet I also came across a few who are still holding on to the little bit of hope they have left in their heart, hope that Lebanon is worth fighting for, hope that someday they can finally build a country they will never have to escape. This is the story of August 4, 2020, told by the people of Beirut. People who came together and gave their all when they had nothing left. People abandoned by their government and left to survive the aftermath of one of the most powerful explosions in the world on their own. People I shared hugs and tears with, people whose strength I admire, whether they chose to leave or remain in the country. It's a story of loss, trauma, and survival. And it's also a call for justice, accountability, and closure. The content of this podcast can be pretty graphic and horrifying. There is no happy ending, yet at least. This podcast isn't for sensitive ears or for children. If it's starting to feel like too much, just switch it off. August 5, 2020. My crew picked me up at 6:30 a.m., and off we drove to St. George Hospital, one of the most damaged ones by the blast. It was the first location I had to go live from. I was running on 1 hour of sleep, and like most people in Beirut, the shock caused by the previous day's events hadn't left me, and I was running high on adrenaline and coffee. Lots of coffee, but no food at all. Not only had I lost my appetite, I didn't have a minute to think about eating. As soon as I got in the car, I was already live on a foreign radio station talking about what had happened. As we were driving, we looked around us, aghast at the scene unfolding in front of us. Destruction was everywhere. Shattered glass and debris in every street, old buildings on the verge of collapse. These streets I knew so well. My favorite restaurants and cafes in ruins. Could I be living a nightmare? I thought. Someone please wake me up. My beloved Beirut was gone, and it was the most heartbreaking thing I had ever witnessed. Back in Jemaisi, Aline hadn't slept either. As she was strategizing about ways to move forward from this disaster, she wasn't aware she was going to be helping many in need.
So after the explosion, around 4:30 a.m., after putting everyone in the hospitals and make sure that everyone is getting the necessary treatment, I called my contractor and I asked him to join me at my rig. And I told him, you have 1 week. I want to reopen my restaurant. Obviously, he laughed at me. It took us 29 days to reconstruct the basics, only the terrace. The second day, I'm like, we didn't sleep, of course. The second day when we were trying to clean, we noticed that we are in my restaurant and we don't have neither water nor food. And I asked from my chef that we have another restaurant from there to send us some food. By the time he sent us, like, we were like 12. By the time the food arrived, we were like above 50 volunteers to help clean the place. I asked my chef to send more food. And this is where the people of the region started to come over because they don't have houses, they don't have food, they don't have anything. So they came to pass by to see what's going on and how they can take some food. So we started to distribute food. We started to distribute first day sandwiches. We distribute around 100. The second day, 200. And by Saturday, we were at 2,500 hot meals.
And so began Aline's mission to feed hundreds of families who had either lost their homes or who just couldn't afford a hot meal. She partnered with World Central Kitchen, a non-for-profit NGO devoted to providing meals in the wake of disasters. For 3 months, many volunteers flocked to her kitchen, and together they cooked thousands of meals on a daily basis. I've heard of many such inspiring initiatives in the weeks that followed. While humanitarian aid and donations kept pouring in from countries around the world, Lebanese people took it upon themselves to help in whatever way they could. One of them is Françoise Nermé. On the day of the explosion, she immediately drove to nearby hospitals to help doctors and nurses who were struggling with the influx of wounded people. Then she started donating food parcels on her own before teaming up with friends and volunteers to distribute food and other necessities. She shared her experience on the ground with me.
So I started putting out posts on Instagram asking for food parcels, for used clothes, shoes, stuff they don't need at home. And then one of my friends called me in this afternoon and she said, listen, we're going to do an initiative and we're going to do food parcels for everyone. Are you in? I said, of course, count me in. And I wasn't working at the time, so I had a lot of free time on my hand. So we took a space in a closed restaurant in Jaladib. He donated the space for us and we started collecting food parcels. People we don't know started coming into the shop and they would just donate everything from their home. Not from, like, they wouldn't go to the supermarket and buy stuff. They would just come and tell me, I had this at home. You can donate it. You can put it in a box and give it away. So we were actually doing around 300 to 400 boxes a day. And then people started calling us, would you accept cooked meals? And we said, of course, we'll do that. And we started a cell of moms and people at home just cooking for us and bringing them to the restaurant. And we had like 100 hot meals a day. We would do 500 sandwiches a day apart from the boxes. And We had help from volunteers leading us to the houses that needed those boxes and food and stuff. And then requests started coming in. And like, do you have milk? Do you have medicine? Do you have this? And do you have diapers for older people? And we knew the need was so big that we needed to ask for more. So we started collecting anything that people would donate to. Clothes, shoes, milk, diapers, utensils for the kitchen. And we kept giving and giving, and everything was gone in one day. And we kept collecting the day after, and everything was gone the same day.
As I was driving around with my crew in the days that followed, I saw dozens of tents in and around the areas affected by the blast. Doctors and nurses who had come from all across the country to treat the injured. People distributing food, drinks, and clothes. Machinery sent by private construction companies to remove rubble and debris. And hundreds of volunteers, many of them teenagers, carrying broomsticks and cleaning up the streets. Eli Matta was one of the young volunteers helping with the cleanup in Ma'am Khayel. Like his friends, he didn't hesitate to gather whatever cleaning tools he had at home and knock on doors.
We arrived to Ma'am Khayel. We actually brought our own stuff, from shovels to bags to anything. We started staring at everything. And where can we start? I mean, there's so much rubble. There's so much glass everywhere. And we were like, okay, let's actually ask people if they want any help with something. So we started asking, and you would go up to homes and ask the people that actually lived there if they wanted any help with something. Some people would actually reject us, like maybe they could get afraid from us, maybe people coming in and stealing their stuff or robbing them. But actually, there were people who actually needed the help and were extremely happy with us helping them. And we would actually go into their places and just like start cleaning and cleaning and cleaning, and the cleaning wouldn't stop, you know? There's so much stuff, from broken closets to glass on the floor to doors just blasted off. And there was a lot of blood on the floor, you know? You would actually see the blood while going up the stairs. It's very crazy. We remember seeing just like these footprints of blood on the floor. I mean, can you imagine how much the people were suffering during that time? People actually seeing us as a youth, just trying to help them. It made them so happy, you know, because they would just like say, Allah yberekon, Allah yakhlina yakun antu jil jdid, you know. This really made us feel so good about ourselves, like we're actually doing something to help the people of Ma'am Khayel, and just like trying to build back everything that was ruined, you know, because like the government wasn't doing anything about that time, you know.
Eli was right. Our government wasn't there. Apart from a few soldiers standing here and there, not one tent was raised, not one sandwich was distributed, and not one doctor was sent on behalf of the Sulta. NGOs and volunteers were responding to the crisis instead, doing a job that should have been handled by the government. While French President Emmanuel Macron was quick to visit Lebanon, touring the affected areas on foot, hugging and comforting residents who had lost their homes and loved ones, not one Lebanese politician issued an explanation to what had happened, although many of them were aware of the presence of ammonium nitrate at the port prior to the explosion. Not one of them issued a single apology, trading blame amongst each other instead. I was talking about this with Maya Shams Ibrahim Shah, who heads Beit al-Baraka, an NGO she founded in 2019, which provides food, decent livelihood, medical services, and education for underprivileged people. Of course, Maya and her team are on the ground helping with home rehabilitation and providing food and medical care to those who needed it. She told me how much she was impressed by the youth and talked about the importance of the Lebanese diaspora in rebuilding Lebanon and its economy.
The young generation was asked to grow up overnight and suddenly become very responsible adults. And this is fantastic, because imagine what amazing adults they're going to be. I mean, imagine how lucky Lebanon is to have this new generation growing up now. I mean, this generation that has rebuilt Beirut, the ones who are in their 20s. I mean, I'm so impressed with them. It's unbelievable. I'm in awe with all of these kids. It's surreal. And the fact that the entire diaspora worldwide has empowered them and given them the money without having to go through the government, because we all know that if the money had gone through the government, it would have probably evaporated. Not even probably, definitely. So I think this trust and the bond between the diaspora and Lebanese youth, local youth, is a match made in heaven. The diaspora today is the guardian angel of Lebanon. And every time someone tells me, my friend is traveling, my neighbor left, everybody's leaving, I say, that's even better, because they're going to send fresh dollars to Lebanon and they're going to make Lebanon survive, because without this money and without the diaspora, Lebanon would have sunk ages ago. The diaspora has been sending money ever since the end of the Civil War. International remittances were worth billions of dollars every year. But today, sending the money directly to NGOs and empowering NGOs that are formed, most of them, of very young people, is what is rebuilding Lebanon today.
As Maya mentioned, money and donations were wired directly to NGOs and youth-led initiatives, as many Lebanese in the country and abroad had lost trust in the government. Donors, Lebanese and foreigners alike, wanted to make sure the money was going in the right hands. Personally, I remember people contacting me on social media and asking which NGOs were the most reliable. Other than Beit al-Baraka, one I would often recommend was Basecamp, a youth-led coalition of four local nonprofits offering disaster relief services to households impacted by the blast. Activist Lina Bubis, who worked with volunteers at Basecamp, told me what it was like.
Inside Basecamp, there was Baitna Baitak. There was Embrace for the mental health. There was Mawatin Lebanani helping with the food and the boxes for the people, because the people after the 4th of August, they didn't have any ovens, they didn't have any fridges. So they used to provide them with their basic needs, basic food for every day to live on. There was a lot of people injured. We used to take care of them. There was doctors and nurses. We used to help them because there wasn't a lot of hospitals that they would go there. You know, the people living there in the environment, they needed help after the blast. We used to go and help. There was a lot of engineers who volunteered from all over Lebanon, even people coming from outside to volunteer, from the States, from London. All this Lebanese youth that I'm very proud to have been with them. And I'm in awe for this generation. I have a lot of respect for this generation. They did what we couldn't do.
Help was everywhere indeed, and it was heartwarming to see so much solidarity among people. But those affected by the blast didn't only need food, medical care, or houses to be repaired. Many of their wounds were invisible, and mental health support was never more needed. I had a chat with Dr. George Kedem, chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and Clinical Psychology at St. George Hospital and president of IDRAC, an NGO dedicated to mental health in Lebanon. He told me they were overwhelmed with work.
2-3 days after the blast, you know, once we started realizing what happened and the terrible shock that happened, we decided that, you know, we have to take care of our community. We have to take care of the employees of the hospital, but also anyone that has been affected by the blast. So within 3 days, we established a hotline for anyone to call and they can receive first aid, psychological aid, obviously free of charge. And that hotline was staffed 24/7 by professionals that were answering the phone calls. Within 7 days after the blast, we were able to inaugurate a walk-in clinic in the middle of the rubble. So the hospital again was destroyed and we just devised a room where we closed it with some wood paneling in order to have a privacy. And we started having a walk-in clinic. We were flooded at the beginning. We were having around 20, 30 people coming in every day seeking psychiatric help. That's in addition to everyone that was calling the hotline.
My friend Elias Ayoub, who's a humanitarian worker, was telling me about his experience working with children and their parents in impacted areas. His NGO was conducting activities for children to help them deal with trauma.
We all have our stories of the day of the explosion, and each of us has felt the impact of this enormous event. So you can just imagine what a child must have gone through that was close to the explosion site, and even children that were not close to the explosion site, children that were kilometers away, that felt the blast, that saw the pictures afterward, and were trying to make sense of what had happened in Beirut. And there was really one striking story that always sticks with me, and there's a father who came up to us after seeing his son taking part in an activity, and he was smiling, and he told us, and this was about a week after the explosion, he said, you know, my son hasn't smiled since the explosion happened, and I'm literally shocked that he's participating in the way that he is, and he's smiling and he's happy, even if it is for just that hour. And so it's these types of stories that really, again, touch us really deep in our work and really reflect the type of impact that something as simple as, you know, playing a game with a child and giving them the space to be able to explore what they'd been through, but a safe space, of course, and to be able to work through the different emotions and feelings that they're going through, to be able to cope, basically, with the tragic events that took place.
As hard as it was for children to cope, it was even harder for parents. I remember I was interviewing people in Man Khail for a report when a woman approached me in tears, pleading for help. She told me she couldn't afford to take care of her children anymore and asked me if I could help her find someone to adopt them abroad and provide them with a better life. I was speechless at first. I had no idea how to respond to this, and then all I could feel was sadness and anger. Anger at our political class for bringing us so low. Lebanon was already going through a series of crises largely blamed on the Sulta, and as Elias told me, the explosion was the final blow for many.
There was a sense of hopelessness that we saw when we talked to many people, that this was it, this was the end. There was no way forward. This was the final nail in the coffin for the Lebanese people. This was a general feeling that was felt by everybody on the ground. And so when you're in that situation, when you're that deep into a sense of hopelessness, apathy, depression, it's very difficult to look outside of that and really try and go beyond that, to be able to activate yourself to manage and respond to what's going on around you.
The tragedy of August 4 not only took hundreds of lives, injured and displaced thousands of people, and destroyed the city, it also left deep emotional scars in many of us that may never go away. In the next episode, we'll be talking about our collective trauma, our scars, and how we've been dealing with them. Many of those I've spoken to will share how caring for others in these difficult times helped them cope with grief and loss.
I had survivor's guilt. I didn't think it was fair that I was okay and that nothing had happened to me, and that little kids had lost their lives.
That's why I feel it's very important to talk about how you're feeling. And I was trying to tell everyone, it's okay to talk about it. Please talk about it, because that helps. We have to go see someone to talk about it.
We are full of scars. Some of them you see, some of them you don't. The one you don't hurts much more than the one you see. We are living with it, and we are trying to understand and make the best out of it. And this is our way of telling that we are continuing.
Just to see how you can help others and to see that you can do a small change in the life of others was a big change for us. And that's how we are able to continue.
Our hearts go out to everyone who's lost their loved ones, their homes, to everyone who was forced to leave their country behind to build a better future for themselves. Thank you for listening to our story. Don't hesitate to share this podcast if it has moved you in any way. We need the world to hear about our fight for justice. Beirut Blast is a Rising Giants Network production, written and narrated by myself, Linda Tamim, mixing and sound design by Bashar Najjar and Saad Kiswani. Beirut Blast is available on Apple Podcast, Anghami, Spotify, Deezer, Podio, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe and rate Beirut Blast on your favorite podcast app.
It's intern Gian. Celebrate the coziest season with Safeway. They're bringing all the fall flavors to you. From pumpkin everything to caramel apples and all of your seasonal favorites. Make the most of those fireside dinners, game-winning touchdowns, and warm family gatherings. Visit your neighborhood Safeway today or shop online for easy pickup or delivery. They're here to help you spice, season, and savor every moment. Sincerely, Safeway.